Okay, great. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Nadia, and I'm an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I'm going to start off by going through a little presentation and then pass it on to everybody else. But first, I want to give everybody on the panel a chance to introduce themselves. So just start from my left.
Hi, I'm Gordon Hall, and for the last 2 years I've been working in the cryptocurrency space, primarily leading the engineering team at BitPay until recently moving on to ChangeTip. So that's me.
Hi, I'm Randall Schwartz. This is my 13th DragonCon, so you may have seen me at previous ones, and very happy to be back again. My background is primarily programming and teaching and writing. Some of you may know me from my podcast, Floss Weekly. Anybody here at Floss Weekly fan?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. All right.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. I am the U.S. Policy Manager at a group called Access Now. We do a lot of things, but amongst those is we have a tech team that provides really robust security advice to activists, journalists, and other users of risk all around the world. I work on our policy team where I'm a lawyer by training, but not one of the bad ones. We just try to help all of the people who are opposing the internet.
Great, so I'm just going to jump into it. We have a lot to cover. So I know that the title of this panel is PGP 101 and Other Surveillance Tools. So we actually wanted to take a step back before talking about PGP and go through, I guess not all of you saw the handout, but go through threat modeling briefly, because basically it is very easy to be overwhelmed by all of the threats that are out there, all of the tools that are out there, all of the people who are trying to sell you tools, because of course, you know, secure messaging and all those things, they're a very big market right now. So we just wanted to start off by sort of zooming out and looking at the big picture. So first off, disclaimer, even though I am technically a lawyer, which is not what I do at EFF, this is not legal advice. This is information, and I hope that it'll be helpful for everybody. So threat modeling. How many people here have heard of threat modeling before they saw my handout? Okay, so this is great. Some folks have, some folks haven't, so we're just going to go through this and think about each of these questions a little bit. So threat modeling, the goal of threat modeling is to really personalize exactly what sort of tools you need to use, what sort of behavior you need to change to yourself and to your own situation. And the reason is perfect security really is not possible. You know, I think even my friends who are the kind of folks who can take apart a laptop and tell you if it's been tampered with, and who can read the open source code of any tool that I'm going to tell you about, would still tell you perfect security is really not possible, especially if you ever want to use the internet. So instead of trying to have perfect security, what we recommend is that people start off before figuring out what tools they want to use by asking themselves these questions. So these are five questions. What do you want to protect? Who do you want to protect it from? How likely is it that you'll need to protect it? How bad are the consequences if you fail to do so? And how much trouble are you willing to go to prevent those consequences? So I'm just going to briefly go through each of these questions and give you a little bit more context on what I am talking about. So what do you want to protect? And I apologize, I know this is not a classroom, but I'm super into audience participation. So I'm just going to ask people to volunteer some of the answers to these, and if you don't, I might call on you, but you're gonna like it. So what do you think? What kind of things do you want to protect?
Identity.
Just shout them out.
Location.
Credit card information.
Passwords.
Social security number.
Internet.
What was that?
Internet history.
Medical information.
Bank statements.
Okay. This is great. So the other thing I wanted to point out that nobody mentioned is sometimes the question isn't what you do you want to protect, it might be who do you want to protect. You might want to think about not just all the things you mentioned, which are all very important, and I'm gonna switch to a list next, but also the information of others and the people that you're communicating with and how they might be vulnerable. So I think we covered most of these: location, search history, contacts, address book, identities of people you're in contact with. That's one of the things I just mentioned. Passwords, of course, text messages, files on computer and hard drive. That's one we didn't mention. Organizing strategies. So this is for people who might be politically active in any way. That might be information that you might want to protect. So who are your potential adversaries? What do you think?
Government.
Who else?
Law
Rivals. Yeah, who in the government, that's right.
NSA.
NSA. Private corporations.
Banks.
Nosy neighbors, banks. Creditors.
Ex-jurors.
Criminal enterprise, that's right.
Anyone who can get value from the information gathered.
Anybody who can get value from the information gathered. Ex-spouse is another one I heard.
Bored Russian teenagers.
Now the ex-spouse one is a little bit funny, but it actually is a really big one, especially for anybody who might have ever experienced any sort of domestic violence who's in this room. That's a very serious one. Abusive ex-spouses or current spouses, actually, for some folks who might still be with that partner. Obsessive stalkers, that's a big one. I've experienced that. It's pretty scary. People you used to trust. Mafia, right-wing hackers, media, that's actually definitely, for some folks, that's a big one. Corporations, lobbyists and political parties, that is actually a pretty big one in terms of just the sort of information that that campaign sites might be collecting about you, information that people who are running for office might be buying about you. And then, of course, NSA, FBI, I think it's really important to specifically mention local police. This is a big one now. We don't really think of it when we think of especially sort of our online behavior, but local law enforcement increasingly actually will sit there and just look at Twitter feeds and look at Facebook and look at YouTube and look for evidence of criminal activity and things like that. So all of these are things. And there may be ones on this list that, there may not be things on this list that may be applicable to you. So really think about your own personal situation and how and why these people might be your potential adversaries. And I'm gonna say when I finish going through these, I'm gonna just give you a little brief case study about one of the things that I do and how these questions would apply to me. So how likely is it that you will need to protect it? So this really depends on you personally. And actually, I'm gonna go back to, my animation is giving me trouble, so I'm just gonna not. I'll just stick with this question and I can remember the other two. So I do legal support work. And when I'm not working for the EFF, I do legal support work for demonstrators in Oakland. How many people here have ever seen a picture of a demonstration in Oakland?
Sure.
Not very many. Okay, so I'm just gonna tell you now that demonstrations in Oakland are oftentimes met with really intense force from the police. They're using tear gas, they're using rubber bullets. They are absolutely, they have full-time officers that actually just sit on YouTube and look for videos of people that were at the demonstration so that they can try to charge them. There was a big Public Records Act request recently showing that the Oakland Police Department had been monitoring Twitter to try to find any information about any of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that were happening there. So I am communicating with people who might already have criminal charges. I'm communicating with people who might be telling me details about what sort of demonstrations they're doing and where they're gonna be. So for me, who are my potential adversaries? Obviously the Oakland Police Department, because I don't want them to get that information. I'm trying to help people with the organizing that they're doing. But in addition to the Oakland Police Department, the FBI is actually very involved in looking at these demonstrations. The Department of Homeland Security as well. Also private corporations, for sure. There are a lot of private security companies working in Oakland. They're absolutely paying attention to these things. Just information that I wouldn't want them to get. How likely is it that I'm going to need to protect it? It is very likely. I'm working with a well-known organization. Again, it's not the EFF. This is outside of EFF that I'm doing this work. But I'm working with quite a well-known organization. I'm relatively high profile in this space. It's pretty likely that I'm going to need to protect it. And how bad are the consequences if you fail to protect it? So again, this is very much a personal question for you. The kind of factors you want to think about. So I'll just go back to my own demonstration. How bad are the consequences if I fail to protect information about people's organizing strategies? I also have took a case from one of these demonstrations. How bad are the consequences if I fail to protect my communications with my client as an attorney? They can be very bad. It could put people in jail. It could cause the police to show up at a demonstration that they might not have otherwise shown up at right away, and they could use force. They could be very dangerous for people. These are pretty bad consequences. Anybody who does any work where they are communicating with sensitive populations or just in your personal life, you know, if you ever make calls overseas, you know, you might want to think how bad would the consequences be for the people I'm talking to. So again, it just really depends, but the consequences can range all the way from being annoyed because you're getting targeted ads, which is a reasonable thing to be annoyed about, and it's a reasonable thing to think of in your threat model, right? You don't want to get these targeted ads, you don't want companies knowing all the shopping that you're doing. So it can range from something like that to really, you know, people going to jail, people dying for people who are doing human rights work. It can be very, very serious consequences. So this is something that you figure out for yourself depending on what sort of activities you participate in and what you're concerned about. So this is the last question that you want to ask yourself. How much trouble are you willing to go to prevent those consequences? So again, personal question, you know, for me, I am willing to, and really I need to be willing to, go to a lot of trouble to prevent those consequences. As a lawyer, lawyers have the ethical duty to protect their communications with their client. They have the ethical duty to advocate for their client. You know, I should really be considering it part of my duty as a lawyer to protect those communications, and I have to go to a lot of trouble. I have to be willing to. Otherwise, I shouldn't be doing that sort of work. Now, this is, again, you're going to think about specific tools. So the reason I bring this up is because we are going to talk about using encrypted email. Encrypted email is a very, very useful and very necessary tool in some situations. In some situations, it's not. There are other tools that you can use that are end-to-end encrypted. So it depends on exactly why you want to do certain things. And how much trouble you personally are willing to go to. This also means that you don't have to learn how to use encrypted email if that's not the right tool for you. You don't have to learn how to use all of these tools. You figure out which ones work, which ones correlate to how much trouble you're willing to go to, and then learn how to use them. So just a couple of questions to ask yourself. Particularly, what habits do I need to change? We are going to talk about what encryption is. I hope somebody's going to cover specifically what end-to-end encryption is. If not, then I can do that. What tools and programs can I use? A good place to start is the EFF Surveillance Self-Defense site, and I'm going to have that URL up here. How do I know what tools to trust? We actually have a whole module on the Surveillance Self-Defense site talking about this, and that is partly, as I said, because you know, we are seeing a lot of sort of snake oil tools out there that are supposed to be secure messaging and things like that. So the starting point is, in terms of knowing what tools to trust, is if you can find open source tools, that means that the code that those tools is written with can be reviewed. It's open to being reviewed. They may not be free tools, but open source is generally preferable. If it's not an open source tool, then you want to make sure that it has gotten a very good and well-regarded security audit. And even that, you can't do it yourself or have somebody trusted do it for you. There's going to be less people that have looked at the tool, but at the very least, there should have been some sort of audit of the tool. So these are the kind of things that you can find on Surveillance Self-Defense: how to use encrypted email, calling, chat, and texting tools, how to create good passwords, and this is really important. I'm going to touch on passwords really briefly before I pass on. How to delete your data, all of these. This is all on Surveillance Self-Defense. I'm going to skip over this. I'll just say it really, really quickly. I'm not going to talk about end-to-end encryption, but encryption takes information, makes it unreadable, except to the person that has the key to unlock it, who knows how to decrypt it into a readable form. So how do you use encryption every day? The reason I put a question mark next to some of these is because not all of these sites are actually going to use encryption. Email. How many people here use Yahoo email? Okay, a couple people in the back. So Yahoo was one of the last email services that actually had their login HTTPS. So HTTPS means that you are using the encrypted version of the site. It means that the information that you're typing in, when it's getting sent to Yahoo, it's encrypted. They were one of the last companies that actually did that. They do have encrypted email now. I'm not saying anything about their security right now, but I can't imagine there are other email sites out there that still have unencrypted logins. I really hope not. But I mean, we're going to save questions till the end, if that's okay.
I just wanted to make a comment.
So we're going to save it until the end. So search engines, the reason I put a question mark is because sites like Google do have encrypted, they have HTTPS versions, and they also have HTTP versions. So whenever possible, you want to use the HTTPS version. Donation websites, anybody see the Ted Cruz site when it came out, didn't have secure donations on it? Yeah. And then browsing. A lot of the browsing that you're doing is not going to be encrypted. So HTTPS everywhere, I'm just going to plug this tool really quickly. This is an add-on for Chrome and Firefox that forces your browser to go to the HTTPS version of a site when it exists. So not every site has an HTTPS version. You want to use it when possible. This extension makes it really easy to do. So I'm just going to touch on these tools briefly and then pass it on. So Redphone/Signal, this is an app that allows you to make end-to-end encrypted calls. They're calls that happen over data, so they don't happen over the regular phone lines. That means the call quality is usually not very good, but it also means that only you and the person that you're talking to know what you're saying. And those words that are shown down there in the bottom are the way that you verify that you're actually talking to the person that that you think you're talking to. They'll have those same words pop up on their screen, read them, make sure that you're actually talking to the right person. So I think what I'm gonna do is just talk about passwords and then pass it on, because there are probably more slides in here than I have time for. But passwords are very, very important. So I'm gonna ask a very embarrassing question, and I'm gonna be embarrassed too. How many people here have ever reused a password? Ever reused a password on more than one site? Okay, yeah, what about a username? So I added username in there because I recently had the experience of figuring out why you should never do that. Somebody brute force got me out of one of my accounts. It's embarrassing, own fault. So lock everything. If you have a phone and you can put a pin on it, do it. You should always have a password on your computer, right? I know that seems like, just do it, and if you haven't done it, don't feel bad, just do it now. And when I say lock your phone, I don't mean like have like a 3 or 4 digit long, it needs to be a little bit longer than that. Use two-factor authentication whenever possible. So two-factor authentication is where when you try to log into a site, it just means that your login is going to be authenticated in some way other than just the password. So the most well-known example, I think, for most folks is Google Gmail. When you can log into your Gmail account, and you have to also enter in a code that gets sent to your phone. So this is a way that if somebody is trying to get in, maybe they've compromised one account there and they are trying to get into your Gmail, they need to have your phone also. And the nice thing about Google's two-factor authentication is you can also get, you can print out backup codes, so if you do lose your phone, you're not completely in trouble. And most two-factor authentication has some sort of backup for you, so you're not going to be completely locked out of your account if you lose your phone and if you lose your password. Use a password safe with a strong master password. If you actually have different passwords for every site, which the reason I asked, so we've all reused passwords. I mean, if you've been using the internet for a long time, maybe then it's hard to imagine that you haven't ever reused a password. That is really, really bad security practice. That's like, if you don't do anything else after this, I want you to just go home and change all of your passwords, make them secure, and make them unique. Now, in order to do that, how you ever remember all those passwords. I was about to like ask some sort of interactive question about how many accounts you have, but that's just ridiculous. I can't even count how many different passwords I have at this point. So it would be impossible to remember all of those if they were actually secure passwords. So using a password safe, this is a program that will save all of your passwords for you. It's an encrypted database, it's stored on your computer. And obviously the most important thing if you're gonna use a password safe is you need to have a very, very strong master password that you can actually memorize. So beware of password recovery questions. This is very common. It's incredible to me that banking sites are still using password recovery questions that are based on completely discoverable public information. So whenever you can, what was that?
I lie on those.
Yeah, so that's one way to deal with them. I mean, a lot of these sites will force you to put something in. Sometimes, and that can actually be another use for a password safe, is that you can, of course, then if you get locked out of your password safe, you can't do your password recovery questions either. But yeah, thinking of fake answers, or sometimes they'll let you create your own questions, and if you create your own questions, you have to make sure they were actually something that's not publicly discoverable, and that is pretty uncommon, right? I mean, with the kind of analysis, like, it's just password recovery questions. They're a problem. So a strong password is unique, long, and randomized in some way. So the method that we have on surveillance self-defense that I think is pretty easy to use is DiceWare. So this is a really long list of words, and you roll dice, and depending on what you get, you pick a word from the DiceWare list. And it's randomized, it's based on the roll of a dice, and it's gonna be a very long password. So that's one way to pick a randomized password. You can also, a lot of these password safes will create passwords for you. So, I'm not gonna talk about any other tools right now. I just want to touch on PGP. So PGP has pretty good privacy, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because as far as we know, and I think it's very important to never make promises, as far as we know, PGP is still secure. That's, you know, based on somewhat old slides and NSA agents complaining about not being able to decrypt encrypted emails, but still pretty good bet. And the reason that I have this picture up here particularly is because I don't know how good I would be at PGP if I were not using Enigmail and Thunderbird. This is a very easy way to set up PGP. Enigmail is a plugin for Thunderbird, and Thunderbird is free. Enigmail is free, and it makes it pretty, I think, pretty user friendly to use encrypted email. It helps you download keys from servers and gives you all these different options, so you can just encrypt everything. You can force encryption. You can sign something, so that's that means the email itself is probably not encrypted, but you're signing it to show that it was actually sent from you. It's pretty user friendly. So with that, I'm just gonna put up these if anybody wants to write them down, and I'm going to pass it on. And yeah.
So it's PGP 101. So how many people gonna show hands have used PGP before? Okay. How many people use PGP every single day? Okay, cool. So for those of you who have not used PGP before or are unfamiliar with the concept of what's called asymmetric cryptography, here's kind of a basic analogy I like to use on how it works. You have two sets of keys, one that you keep private and one that is public. That's the designations to the names there. You can kind of think of your public key as a sort of padlock instead of a key. So if let's say I go to Home Depot and I buy 10 padlocks and 10 boxes, and I give those padlocks to 10 of my friends, and they want to give me something. They want to give me something that only I can read. They put a message or they put something in this box and lock it with my padlock, to which only I have the key to unlock. And that's sort of how PGP works. And that's sort of how asymmetric cryptography in general works. So it relies on you never revealing your private key or losing that. So it's just like a password, in that you still have to keep that incredibly secure. You have to, you want to maybe encrypt the disk that it's stored on, or you want to lock it with a password, keep the private key encrypted itself. But since the show of hands was pretty wide, there's people who use PGP, I guess, really would be, if anyone has any questions, maybe tools, and we went through a lot of tools already. I'll just pass it on.
Well, I could just make a couple comments on yours.
Yeah.
Split. All right, so I have, according to 1Password, I have 1,700 accounts. So, of course, I'm a social media butterfly, so I sign up for everything as it comes along. And most of them use the same username because I want to be actually connected for all of those. But very different passwords for everyone of those. That's really nice. The other thing I wanted to say is that Apple forced me to have 3 passwords, and I use a cryptographically strong random word generator. As the 3 answers, I keep that one password. That's one way to get around all this.
Yeah. I mean, to add on to that, I will say, so I don't use a different password for every single one. I have a password reuser, but I am a very specific, I have threat model myself, and there are very specific accounts that I have access to that actually don't have any information in them at all. Have you ever gone to a website and been forced to create an account in order to view the content on the website? Like a news website? I really don't care what happens with that password.
And even the ones that lure you in by saying you can use your Facebook account as your account, and then they make you fill out an account form anyway.
Then they get access to all your Facebook information.
It's like,
So, but the wonderful thing that happened to me with one of those the other day, like this just happened 2 weeks ago, is I signed up for one of these junk accounts, and they sent me an email automatically, as they all do, and it said, here is your password.
Oh, God.
And I thought, well, there goes that junk password. And it really is. It was a short five password throwaway that if anybody guessed, it had no information that I didn't care, but I had to throw them up and to say that's okay. And now that password is totally compromised, so any of the news accounts that I had signed up for with that password, somebody could get access to very easily. And so that's the kind of situation we're dealing with. I told the story in a panel yesterday, so I apologize if anybody has to listen to me ramble a second time, that earlier this year, people had thought that Dropbox had been hacked. And there was a big uproar, there was a lot of headlines. Dropbox has been hacked, all of your information is hacked. And the great thing about it was that Dropbox had not been hacked at all. What had happened was a lesser website with no digital security in it had been hacked. And they got a hold of all these usernames and passwords and they started plugging them into Dropbox. And people's Dropbox information was being released because of valid access to these accounts that was achieved because people were reusing their username and passwords on many different websites. And so the news stories came out and as Dropbox has been hacked because a lot of people's Dropbox information was being leaked on the web, and that wasn't the case at all. It was all because of password reuse. So I think that is one of the big problems that we all fall victim to, that is probably one of the more fixable problems if you just use a password manager, if you are aware of where you're signing up and where you're using your information over and over again. The other thing I want to ask is how many people, raise your hand if you have a smartphone. No, keep them up. Put them down. Now, put your hands down if you have not taken some sort of action to encrypt the hard drive on your smartphone. Proactively encrypted the hard drive on your smartphone. So only hands up if you've actually encrypted your smartphone. Okay, now put your hands back up if you have the most recent iPhone. Because that's by default, so you don't have to take proactive action to have that encrypted. So it's incredibly easy to encrypt the hard drive on your phone, to have all the information stored on your phone encrypted, but so many people don't do it. You plug it in, it takes about 20 minutes, and then imagine if all of the photos on your phone got breached. Would you rather have, and this is one of my favorite questions to ask on panels, raise your hand if you would rather have the photos on your phone breached than your credit card number. That you think your photos are less vulnerable than your credit card. Less important. Your photos are less important than your credit card number.
Just food, right?
Yeah. I'm curious, how many people have actively gone in and turned off geotagging on their phones? That's great. Good stuff.
Every picture, if you don't turn it off, has geotag and figure out where you've been. Pictures of your friends, where food.
I'd like to share a really brief story on threat modeling real quick. So about a year ago, I made a vow to myself that I was going to use only 100% free and open source software for everything. So this meant running Replicant on my Android phone. This meant I was running Facebook Linux. I wouldn't install any apps, use F-Droid exclusively. And so it was a very long and grueling experiment to do this. And I actually got really, really accustomed to it pretty quickly. So, and people looked at me like I was crazy, like, what the hell is that app that you're using right now? I've never seen this before. And it didn't strike me. I had just a sort of awakening when I visited San Francisco recently for the first time. And I was trying to use OpenStreetMaps to find my freaking hotel. And I realized it was extremely nerve-wracking. I got really anxious, and I didn't know where I was. And it was so it brought me back to, why am I doing this? And the initial why was it was an experiment, but also I believe very strongly in privacy. But the point where the software choices that I made caused me anguish, that was the moment where I said, okay, shit, I have to install Google Apps on my phone now so I can find my hotel. So threat modeling is a very important part of the process of securing yourself. If you're causing yourself unnecessary, problems, then maybe it's time to get a burner phone, with your Google phone for everything, you want Google to sell for you. So.
One of the things that this panel was pitched to me as is, what do we do in a post-it, Edward Snowden, Erickson?
It's only Eric Snowden if you're in the U.S. Senate and you are currently debating USA freedom. Sorry.
Okay, Eric.
Really bad inside joke.
Eric Snowden. Okay,
the nerds out there.
It's a little late. It's day three of the con. Okay, so Eric Snowden, what happens in a post-Eric Snowden world? Does anybody here believe that none of their emails been tapped in the last week? Okay, and that's the point. So this is why we got to look at end-to-end encryption. We have to actually, before it even gets on the wire, you know, make sure that you are exchanging keys with your participants. And it's a lot of work. But if you, you know, if you're, especially if you're like journalism panel, that there's, you know, if you're a journalist talking to a private source and you're not doing that in end-to-end encryption, you're leaking information that the government certainly is going to take use of. And it doesn't have to matter. It doesn't matter that it's illegal. What they do is they build up a parallel case based on what they can find using illegal mechanisms. They'll build up and use those as, you know, possible phishing holes to go get the real data using normal methods. And that's been the biggest thing that I've seen that's come out of the Snowden revelations, is this whole parallel case thing.
So I think we can move to questions, and I'm sure all of us can keep talking. You don't have questions, but I'll bet somebody does. I see some hands. We should start from the back and then move up.
Just because he was first.
Quick question. Same area.
We have a.
You don't have the key. Don't talk.
Oh, the black. You're talking good.
Okay.
There you go. Cool. Stingrays. I hear more and more about that in the news, and that's one of the things Snowden's talked about, is how local law enforcement is, you know, exceedingly abusing this and has been for even longer. What can we do to protect ourselves, just in the common man, or just do what you said in the panel, or is there anything else?
So I have really bad news about stingrays, which is at this point, there is not any way. So basically the best thing you can do to defend yourself against stingrays is if you are somewhere where you're concerned about your locational information being gathered and you think there might be a stingray in use, you should use a burner phone. So if you're going to, and honestly, anybody here who's planning on going to a demonstration and you have any concern whatsoever about anybody knowing you were there, you should probably bring a burner phone at this point. And the reason I say that is because stingrays, there's no app that can protect against stingrays. The only thing we can do, so there's an app called Snoop Snitch. It requires a rooted phone to use. It's not always accurate, and all it does is even tell you if there's stingrays being used. So at this point, there's not a way to protect against them, and I will say that, you know, law enforcement is saying that they're using stingrays only to find people's location. Plenty of local law enforcement has said that stingrays can't capture the content of text messages. That is not true. Stingrays are, you know, I don't know how they're using them, but the fact that they say that they can't do that is not true.
So just for everybody's information, because there are some confused looks, stingrays are fake cell phone towers that you can pop up that mimic real cell phone towers and have you connect your phone to them. Some of them can be passive and wait for you to try to connect to a tower. Some of them are more active and will actually ping phones out into the world and try to get phones proactively to connect to them. And then they'll get information from your cell phone based on that. Largely what we're talking about here is location data. They can pick up location from a wide area, like a 3-hotel radius in Atlanta, for example. They can get a lot of location information from areas like that. So they're fairly invasive. One of the problems with stingrays is what they're gathering, for the most part, is metadata. And one of the things that we haven't solved yet in the security space, for the most part, there are tools like Tor that do try to obfuscate your metadata, but it's very, very, very hard to keep your metadata secure. The information about your information. So again, not necessarily the content of your text messages, but where you're sending them from, who you're sending them to, how large that file is, things like that. The information is very hard to secure. Specifically on the topic of stingrays, just to add on, there was recently, as in
2 days
right before I came to Atlanta,
yeah, day before yesterday,
a DOJ policy, not law, that was released that said you have to use a warrant before you use a stingray, except for a laundry list of circumstances that they can still
bad
use
guys.
Them without a warrant in. And there are still a lot of NDAs. For some reason, the FBI made local law enforcement sign NDAs about having had stingrays before they were able to procure them, which is very strange, and it goes back to the parallel construction issue. We're not going to say how we're gathering your information, we're just going to use it, and then if we ever have to use it in court, we're going to try to figure out a different way we could have come up with that information in order to prosecute you. What we found is that actually, you know, all of these tools are to keep us safe, right? We're told that all the time, that to keep us safe. Law enforcement have let cases go, have decided not to pursue cases rather than tell people how they're surveilling them. Rather than reveal the tools they're using for surveillance, law enforcement would rather let the criminals go free. So not only are they not keeping us safe, but they're actually letting criminals go in order to hide their techniques.
Also keep in mind that the government, some parts of the government, has run tour exit outs. So tourism is
out. What you were talking about earlier about the passport safes, having just spent the morning on a password adventure where I forgot the lies that I put in on my bio information again that way either. Are there any of those applications that are transferable, or you can send the payload back and forth, or that will sync? Because what I find is I'll keep a document or something encrypted on one device, that, but then I have to change the password where I'm somewhere else on a different device, and keeping all those updated.
A lot of that is threat model. So there are different passwords. There's open source, something like KeePass that you can use. There's something like LastPass that you can use. These are both password managers. One of them stores the keys on your own device, so you have control of your passwords, but then you have to have access to the physical device in order to get them. The other one will store your passwords in the cloud, and they can change them all at once, and they say they're very secure, and you can access them from anywhere, but you no longer have physical control over them. So when we talk about the give and take for some security tools, it's a matter of which one of those things matters more to you, and then you choose what tool you use based on what you care about.
And I'll add to that, most people don't seem to know about Jada Cloud. How many people know about Jada Cloud in here? See, like two, right? When Dropbox thing happened a couple of years ago, Jada Cloud came out and said, we don't have any access to your data, and we're in Norway. It's got some of the strongest privacy rules in the world. And it's $100 a month, $100 a year for unlimited storage in the cloud. It's encrypted end-to-end. You still have to protect your local disk because it basically looks like Dropbox. It's going to unencrypt it locally. So you still have to protect that. But once it's on the wire, it can go to a central place in Norway and nowhere else. They own their own systems. They're not clouding it out. And the Norway privacy rules are very, very strong. The likelihood of a U.S. corporation or the U.S. government getting access to your Norway data is very, very low. It's called Jotta Cloud, JOTTACLOUD.com. Yeah, I found out about that a couple years ago, and I'm using it. I tell you, it's how I send all my data around. JOTTA. Actually, it's like Yada, but whatever. JOTTA.cloud.
Yep. I think hopefully we will have enough time to get to everybody, so we'll just move up from the front team.
Only if I shut up.
The question I had, when you're talking about PGP, are you literally talking about the cool PGP that went commercial a long time ago, or are you essentially talking about GPG?
I'm talking about GPG, okay. And I will say for anybody who's not familiar, both of the people use those interchangeably. It's a long discussion about why or why not, but I use GPG.
Okay, and that's why
I'm not using the commercial tool.
And that's what I was wondering, because when I do research on this, you know, PGP seems to have basically died, and GPG replaced it 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, but people do use it interchangeably, and it's, I think that it makes sense to use it interchangeably.
I have mine set up in GPG tools. It's something that you can go to online if you're looking for things to write down. I see some people type it. GPG tools is how I set up my key to do everything else.
For a map, right?
Yes.
Okay. I think there was a hand right there, and then we'll move on over to this side, and then come on up here.
All right, that's got a different thread. Currently, they're in the process of putting gigabit fiber in my front yard. And so AT&T, of course, sent me a flyer to make sell it to me. And the biggest thing I noticed is they collect the data for targeted advertising, and there's no way out of it. There isn't an option where I can pay an extra $10 a month to avoid it. There isn't an option where I can get a business line and avoid it. They basically said, if you want to get onto this fiber tab, that's what you have to do. What out there exists for me to, I guess, get around it? What's my best option? Because my first thought was a VPN. The trouble is, trying to get a VPN that saturates a 5 megabit connection is a nightmare. On a gigabit connection, it sounds impossible.
So So it depends on where you are, and that's the most frustrating answer, I think. You know, if you're lucky and you're in a place like San Francisco, there are other options. There's satellite internet providers. This is definitely, when it comes to internet service providers, is definitely a situation where sometimes you will sacrifice speed for better privacy. So I live in the Bay. I use Sonic.net. They are a really great company. EFF does a report called Who Has Your Back? It's a really great resource, and if you're wondering about how various companies deal with government requests for data, it's a great thing to look at. We have the newest version, the 2015 version. Sonic was one of the first companies that actually got top marks on that, and that's because they don't keep your data. They will do everything they can to fight government requests. They are unfortunately a reseller of AT&T. They're on DSL, Monkey Brains, which is another company in San Francisco, is a satellite internet provider. So I think if you have a choice, you have to, sort of do your own threat model and decide if you're going to sacrifice for less speed. I haven't had that yet with AT&T.
And this goes just as a metadata problem again. There are ways that you can protect what you're looking at from them seeing. It's harder or the physical content, it's harder for them to need to protect your metadata against what they see. With businesses, you are their customer, which means you don't necessarily always have a choice, but you can put pressure on the company. And so one of the things to always remember is you're giving them your money, they also have to listen to you. Shareholder meetings, oddly enough, companies want to buy a piece of stock in AT&T. Showing up at shareholder meetings is something Access has found success in. We actually go to AT&T shareholder meetings sometimes and provide feedback to the company, and it's been very interesting. But you should know, like, even tools like Do Not Track, which try to tell you that they're opting out of the tracking, often opt you out of receiving the advertisements, so you don't see that they're tracking you, you don't have any idea that they're tracking you anymore. It doesn't opt you out of the background tracking itself. Regardless, it's called Do Not Track, and it does not opt you out of the tracking. So it's also being aware of what a company is telling you it is and it's not doing.
And also to note on Do Not Track, there's nothing that actually enforces the receiver of that request to honor it. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Talking about the Do Not Track option.
Yeah. Well, on the weekend, there are quite a few that do deal with more than 5 megabits, but then they aim towards P2P systems for PHP users. So we at Forum Freak have an annual list where we list ones that will have high speed, easily 30, 40, 50 megabit at least, and they are do not log ones, well, that don't leave any kind of activity logs. We do an annual rundown on forumfreak.com.
Yeah. There's
a hand over there. Real quick, AT&T cannot see your traffic if you use HTTPS, so that earlier HTTP everywhere will help with most of that.
This is the second time I've heard y'all say credit card information or photograph information.
That was me too.
Yeah. I have a great curiosity about it. Can Apple, because you go through the cloud, everything goes into the iCloud, it goes into your family sharing. What if they compromised your photographs? Can they work their way into the cloud and then through the cloud to other devices?
So that was actually, the iPhone hack that occurred was actually an iCloud hack. You can turn the syncing off. So you can keep it on your phone. Your phone is most, the new iPhones are default device encrypted. You can turn off the cloud. If you keep the cloud on, you are relying on Apple's security to an extent. So it is that matter of, do you want to be able to access your photos from all of your devices? In which case you rely on Apple's security, or do you want to make sure they're as secure as possible and you keep them on your phone? It's a personal choice that you have to figure out what to make. The same with any cloud tool. Do you trust the cloud? Law enforcement threw a huge fit, which many of you may have heard. There's a panel on it tomorrow about the crypto wars, when Apple said they were going to encrypt their phones by default. And one of the things that we threw back at them is most of you will not turn off iCloud Sync. I would love for you to do that. Most people will not. And then they can still go to Apple. They're like, we can't even go to Apple and get your information anymore, but you have the iCloud turned on and Apple can still see that information, and then the police can still go. It was one of the reasons that law enforcement saying that Apple encryption was going to be the end of the world was incredibly disingenuous.
And to touch on those of you who would like to sync things to the cloud, because it's very convenient, there's a product that's free and open source software called Home Cloud. which you can install on a server that you control, and you can control the encryption there. Who better to trust than yourself? So if you're really concerned with it and you like to be able to have convenience, they have clients for Android, or maybe they have a client for iPhone for syncing, but OwnCloud is a good option for that.
My question for the panel is on the Stingray devices, even in my own neighborhood, we have cell towers, there's nothing on it, no tags or anything, and so I've read about the article where cell towers are kind of showing up all over the country, as well as the mobile Stingrays that they can put anywhere on the street and use it. Are there on mobile devices, are there any symptoms to, you know, the fact that you're on a Stingray? Because sometimes I do a lot of phone calls overseas, my business is mostly overseas, and a lot of times my phone gets so hot for no reason that it feels like it's going to burn up. And so I just wondered what the symptoms might be for being on a Stingray.
Yeah, unusual battery drain can be one of the symptoms, because as we mentioned, the Stingray is trying to trick your phone into connecting, and especially if it's actually trying to, instead of passively, if it's actively trying to trick the phone into connecting with it, unusual battery drain. And I think there was... If it moves to 2G. And sometimes there are... There's questions about whether Stingray can also be used to interfere with.
And there's an underlying problem to this all, is that our phone networks are insecure, and our phone networks are insecure because the government wanted them to be wiretappable. And it's very cheap. Like, Stingrays are not just something cops use. Stingrays can be built very cheaply by anybody, and they're very easy to put together, and you can find the instructions to do it online. And the reason that you can do that is because the US government wanted your phone to be wiretappable for them to be able to access it. This is a common problem. So every time you hear somebody talk about how they need to have access to your communication, it really makes the entire, not only the US population, the entire world incredibly insecure. And now we're seeing the consequences of actions that were taken much longer before, and the fact that your information is like leaking out of your phone to anybody who has an internet connection and wants to build this device.
I think the cost was $1,500 like 2 or 3 years ago.
I think it's under $500 now. But
yeah, back in 3 years ago, we were brand new with $1,500.
There may be Stingrays here.
Possibly.
This isn't DEF CON. There could be Stingrays. yeah, go ahead. And then, are there any in the front that I'm not seeing? Okay, great.
I had an experience yesterday, and I'm wondering if anyone on the panel, or really in the audience, had the same experience of going to install the Android DragonCon app, looking at the permissions it requires, and just like shaking your head.
I didn't even consider installing the app personally.
it's embarrassing when you look at what they require.
Is it free software?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I think you're pointing out a problem that exists for really all apps. I mean, it's ridiculous. You can, when you go and you try to install an app, it asks for all these permissions, and there's no option to say, I don't want you to have this permission and I'll give up this functionality. It usually is an all or nothing. And I strongly encourage you to actually read the permissions on apps that you're using before you install them.
Has anybody not downloaded an app because they looked at the permissions and they shook your head?
Yeah, that's actually really exciting. Really, keep it on, guys.
I carefully read everything that would, like, when I want to connect to Facebook, because I like it to post to my Facebook pages and stuff, but then it asks for all sorts of other things. So I've said no many times.
It's also
good.
Right quick on the Android permissions thing. From what I've read, the expert of Android is supposed to pick a lot of that.
Yeah, part of that is the API, to get access to certain pieces of information that it needs to operate, it needs access to more than it should have. A lot of work can be done on the SDKs to make that.
Also be careful, because this version of Android was also supposed to be hard drive encrypted by default, and they weren't able to get it done in time. So follow through.
So I'm an app host developer, and I manage a lot of sensitive data for some users, like Social Security and other personal data. Is there anything like on a server side? This might be more of a coding question, but are there any like frameworks or like database encryption methods that you guys would suggest? I've done a lot of research into it. There's a lot out there, but
I'm
just saying that's a pretty broad question, so it depends on the things you're actually tying into.
Yeah.
You're talking about Postgres database, you're talking about Apache Web Server, or whatever it is.
Microsoft SQL Server.
Microsoft, really.
MS SQL
Server. So within SQL Server, because I know there was a company that was putting out that was called ZeroDB, which was an encrypted database by default. But if you're talking about working within the constraints of SQL, I'm sure.
Is that and like a lot of .NET technologies, so if you have any like library suggestions for encrypting stuff?
I don't know if it was reported, and I really hope it was. If not, I can at least get you the slides. At Crypto and Privacy Village at DEF CON this year, there was a specific presentation on encryption for app developers, and if it was recorded, you can grab my card afterwards also if I can get it for you.
And this is for users, and I don't know how many tools we have for developers, but on top of EFF's page, accessnow.org/pages/tech also has a like slew of like two resources, including surveillance self-defense, but other guides and things as well that might be useful in both this and other cases. Accessnow.org, accessnow.org, /pages/tech.
And I'm actually going to go ahead and ask you a question. I'm also going to pull up surveillance self-defense on here so that people can see what the site looks like.
While we're talking about mobile app permissions, on iPhone, you can selectively say, yes, I want this, no, I don't want that, for their apps. Is there a way to do something like that on Android while they're still have to install this thing?
Yeah, from what I'm, as an Android user, I'm not able to, I have to agree to all of them. So I use in CyanogenMod, they have a little program built in called Privacy Guard, which allows you to go back and then fine tune those permissions. But as far as what is baked into Android,
with the Privacy Guard, you can have it on by default, just lock everything, and you can turn on.
Well then, yes.
So eventually it's catching up to the iPhone. Okay.
Outside of the kind of this encryption, and while that, there's a product called TrueCrypt, which is no longer supported, and there's a big hype about it's no longer secure.
VeriCrypt is the heir apparent.
And I was wondering if VeriCrypt is that.
Yes, I interviewed the guy that did VeriCrypt. He's an amazing guy. To go back about 10 episodes, you'll hear about him. He's a saint. He's actually carrying this on as a labor of love. He's taken the original code base, he's incorporated all the things that came out of the audit TrueCrypt, and he's kind of on par with that. He's made stronger keys available also, but it is bit for bit backward compatible. If you click the box, we can open a new amount. If you create a brand new VeriCrypt, it will convert an old login to a new login, all for it. It's an amazing thing. Same UI, same command line.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that...
Yeah, it's error apparent, absolutely.
Doing business with a company you trust is very important. A company that maybe has been audited by somebody you trust, somebody has talked to them. Doing the background research before you decide to do business with a company, especially if you're like a VPN provider or a Dropbox like cloud server, making sure that if they have your data, that you trust them having your data, that should be a question you ask yourself in your threat model.
Ahead. One comment and a couple questions. Before the stingrays were mentioned, if you use a burner phone, don't carry your regular phone with you.
That's a really good.
Yes, sir.
You had an app up there earlier, I think it was called Red Phone. Mm-hmm. Do they log or do they dump logs? Because otherwise they're tracking your calls, even if they're not getting your data to the vendor.
That is a good question. Redphone was created by Whisper Systems, and they are actually pretty responsive on their forums. And that would be a good question. It's a question that may have been answered on their forums already.
Okay. And the last question was, does Google Cloud allow again?
Yes.
So just really quickly, because there's tons of stuff on surveillance self-defense, and I think it can be a little bit overwhelming if you don't know what you're looking for. So playlists are curated lists of things that we think would be useful for specific people. So we have playlists for like LGBTQ youth, journalists, human rights defenders, And then the tutorials, these cover all, you know, a lot of the things we were talking about. So Red Phone, Signal, Tech Secure, Tor, and then overviews are also cover some of the things that we talked about. Creating strong passwords, I recommend everybody take a look at that. Seven steps to digital security. This is and then choosing your tools. That was another one that I mentioned. So these are all just useful tidbits. Yeah.
Okay, this might be like a really dorky question, but when I turn my phone off and I leave it off for a while, then I turn back on, I notice a battery drop. So
turning it off or sleeping it?
Like, no, totally turning it off.
It's still draining slime.
Is it like still tracking me? Like, or is it totally
some
dead?
Some claim that there's still activity going on even when the phone is entirely off. I don't know.
There are weird mentions of something like this. A former colleague of mine was trying to follow up with the government to FOIA the mentions to see what that actually means. It's hints in government documents. I don't know if anybody knows if that's possible or not.
And that's actually a totally reasonable question. I mean, a couple of years ago, people would have probably said, there's no way that the camera on your computer could ever be turned on and you not know it. You know, and it's like the things that we're learning about, I think, every day justify. One of the things I sometimes start off these sessions with is I ask people to raise their hands. I'm going to do it now, actually. How many people here have ever been told that they're conspiracy theorists? Right. So I have good news and I have bad news. And the bad news is, like, You're probably right, and the good news is you're probably right.
I like to say this. I like to say this: the tinfoil hat people aimed too low. It's much worse.
I think we have time for one more. Was there? Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make a comment on the battery drain issue. There was not too long ago an article that came out of India that there were some Samsung batteries that were coming in modified and had trackers wired directly to the batteries.
Well, that never happens.
Yeah. I would want one of those.
Yeah. And again, I just want to make the point that is not surprising. For those who don't know, the NSA has a very, they do that. They do hardware modification, seen evidence of it. They like to accuse the Chinese corporations of doing it, but they're doing it themselves.
And that's one of the reasons why I asked what government agencies right at the beginning. If the NSA is after you and not collecting your information in bulk, like after you specifically, you are the bad guy and they want your information.
And before we break,
they're going, they can compromise your device, they can hack in at root level, somehow they can gain access. And the most perfect security, if you absolutely have perfect security, maybe that's okay. But some threat actors, if you are the target, you are going to have to take extraordinary measures to protect against.
And just before we wrap up, I just also want to let you know that Hacking 101 is coming up in about an hour and a half. I'll be on that panel, and it's in Marriott A61, A602. These types of questions are perfectly within the scope of Hacking 101. So if you have more questions than we didn't get to today, please go out there. It's a lot of fun.
Is the RFID, like you've got those bags you can drop a phone in as well, those are things that can sever signals also, is that correct?
The Faraday.
The Faraday.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you. Can I go to our panel?